Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And boy, Barack Obama just announced his security lineup, as it were. And looks like a great group. Of course, Hillary Clinton spoke first. Not a team of rivals, a team of cooperators. It should be, and a fine thing it is. So we'll see how all this works out as time goes on and time goes by. The situation in India has gotten a lot of ink, and rightly so, frankly. This is a terrible, terrible, disastrous situation. And I want to get into it in some detail here because this does not just affect India. First of all, you've got the situation that started as if it was some sort of a Robert Ludlum novel. You know, these guys, coming in a boat, taking over a ship, slicing the throats of the captain, tossing his hand, tossing him overboard with his hands bound with rope, killed the trawler's four other crew members, dumped their bodies overboard, made it to Mumbai, and made it into these locations. But as I've said, glancingly, I've been to India a number of times. I've done business in India going all the way back to 1979, stayed at the Taj many times, in fact. And in my opinion, Kashmir is to India and Pakistan what the West Bank is to the Palestinians and the Israelis. And it's an imperfect analogy, but one I think probably most Americans would get immediately, and one which Victoria Schofield, an expert on Kashmir, victoriaschofield.com, S-C-H-O-F-I-E-L-D.com. I don't know if you would agree with that or not. Victoria, welcome to the show. Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us here today. Hello?
Hello, yes. Can you hear me? I'm speaking to you from London.
I can. Thank you. And thank you so much for being with us from London, Victoria. Your take on this situation, please.
Well, I think it's a little more complicated with great respect than comparing Kashmir to the Middle East situation. It really is a complicated political position, but I also think we should look more closely at the Kashmir dispute, not so much in connection with the Mumbai attacks, because this Kashmir issue has really moved on from terrorism, and it's now a political issue. In the past months, in fact, we've seen a situation whereby India and Pakistan have been very keen to talk about Kashmir. They've been keen even to involve the Kashmiris in the discussions. And, this is obviously a huge setback when there's a terrorist issue, as we saw in December 2001, on Indian soil, which therefore sets back that peace process between Pakistan and India.
Mm-hmm. But I realize it's a deeply imperfect metaphor. I'm looking for some way to. First of all, would you agree that the root of this violence that we just saw probably exists in Kashmir?
I think it's too early, really, to pin it entirely on Kashmir. There are many organizations operating, and again, when we're talking about terrorism, terrorists operate in cells, and certainly as soon as the extent of the terrorism, as soon as the terrorist act was known, the Kashmiri groups that are working for their self-determination, they're working for a political settlement with the government of India, condemned this act of terrorism. Now, this is not something which, as I say, for the Kashmiris, helps their cause at all, because it already is in the public domain, and certainly what the Kashmiris don't want is for them to be branded as terrorists. Right. They've used the gun, as they admit, in the 1990s when the insurgency began, in fact, in 1989. But as many Kashmiris, many of these militants now turned into political activists have said, the gun took our issue out of cold storage. Now a solution has to be at the negotiating table. And so I'm you know, more than 100% sure that they're horrified at these latest attacks, and they themselves would not condone them. That said, there are organizations who might maintain their working for the Kashmir cause. Sure. And who will take responsibility and say, we're doing this for the unresolved dispute over Kashmir. But certainly those people who really have the hearts and minds of the Kashmiris would condemn these acts of violence.
We're talking with Victoria Schofield. She's an expert on
Schofield.
Schofield. Thank you very much. Did I say it right?
Yes, Schofield.
Schofield. Oh, thank you. I'm sorry. An expert on Kashmir. Her books include Kashmir and the Crossfire, Kashmir and the Conflict, and Afghan Frontier, Feuding and Fighting in Central Africa, a frequent commentator on BBC and BBC World Television as well. And Victoria, to say Kashmir is even to be overly broad. My recollection is there are at least four or five states in that region, including Kashmir and Jammu, if I have that right, that in one you have a principal, you know, like over 90% Hindu population, and in another you have an over 90% Muslim population. I'm doing this all from 15-year-old memory. Please set me straight on this.
Well, you are right. The state, the princely state, it was a princely state, and it was called the princely state of Jammu and Kashmir, which already would indicate to you there is diversity in the region.
Right.
In fact, the region includes several other vast territories, which just to give you the idea that we're talking about a state that's something in the region of the size of Texas, I think. And this state has a sparsely populated region, but those inhabitants who are there are Buddhist, and that's Ladakh. That's under Indian administration. And the state currently divided on the ground between India and Pakistan, one-third roughly controlled by Pakistan, two-thirds by India. That also includes a huge area called the Northern Areas, which is predominantly inhabited by Shiite Muslims. But the area which has really been under dispute has been the Valley of Kashmir. It's known as the Heart of Kashmir. It's the most beautiful region, the green, lush green valley. It's what's inspired poets and romantic writers since, you know, they discovered it. That area is roughly 90% Muslim. The entire state was 75% Muslim. Jammu region is roughly two-thirds Hindu. Those are the current statistics. But the disputed area has really been the valley, and this is where the core of discontent arose in the late 1980s, early 1990s. The inhabitants of the Valley of Kashmir were unhappy with their continuing status as part of the Indian Union, more specifically because they felt they had been promised a plebiscite or a referendum at the time of partition in 1947. And this plebiscite and referendum has never been held. And when the Kashmiris say we want our right of self-determination, this is what they mean. They mean that they would like to decide whether they endorse their status as part of the Indian Union or whether they would prefer an alternative status. Originally, this was whether they would prefer to become part of Pakistan, but now there is a very strong movement for independence. And again, it's complex because it's whether it's independence of the whole state or part of the state.
Right. Yeah, I was in India in 84, 86, and 90, and it seemed that the current more moderate party and then the BJP party, the more right-wing party, you know, the Congress Party and the BJP, there's this, you know, competition, as it were, between the two, and Kashmir occasionally came into that. This is going to bring that to the fore?
Well, it's already, in terms of domestic Indian politics, it's already very much been in the fore, and it's been in the fore in terms of the Indo-Pakistan relationship ever since the insurgency began. The difficulty is that no country gives up land willingly, and much as the Indian government has tried to improve the situation in Kashmir, the thought of any part of the Indian Union, wherever we're talking about, seceding, is very difficult. Yeah. And that's where a political settlement has to be negotiated.
Very well said. Victoria Schofield, her website, VictoriaSchofield.com. I have that right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Good speaking with you. 16 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you and broadcasting live from our studios in New York City, where the headphones are. There we go. Oh my, oh my, oh my, oh my, oh my. No, that's too loud too. There we go. Concerns grow over the ability of states to raise debt. First of all, with regard to Kashmir and Jammu and India and Pakistan and all of this. This is one of those areas where the Bush Doctrine is being demonstrated to be just about as asinine as they come. The lead editorial in today's Financial Times, "The Siege of Mumbai is Over." The headline, "Turning Mumbai's Trial to Advantage, Time to Tackle Regional Conflicts and Isolate Jihadists." And as our guest pointed out, this is a very complex situation. This is a part of the world, a part of the region that is technically under the control of India, at least most of it, and has been under dispute between India and Pakistan ever since 1947. I mean, the timeline on this thing is really in 1946 it was ceded. The Sikh Empire ceded Kashmir to the East India Company via the Treaty of Lahore. And then in 57, there was a war of independence, and this is 1857. 1931, Kashmir's first organized protest. 1940, the Pakistani Revolution. 46, Muslim Conference calls for an autocratic region. In June of 47, the British accept the Pakistan Plan. And on it goes. I mean, it's been going all the way up to this day. It's this long history. But so it looks like, you know, the best guess right now is that the folks in the folks who committed these atrocities in India, if not associated with Kashmiri separatist groups, that is, groups who are saying we want Kashmir to be its own country, and this was where my, as I, you know, admittedly imperfect Palestinian, Israeli, West Bank, Gaza, etc. Metaphor comes in. And as I said, it's very imperfect, but here's where I think it's similar. What you've got here is a long-term festering sore over who gets to control what. And you've got two different religions at odds with each other, in this case, Hinduism and Islam. And in Kashmir, a majority Islamic area. In Jammu, a majority Hindu area. India has gone to war with Pakistan three times now, in large part over this region. So now what happens? are we going to follow the Bush Doctrine, or is India going to follow the Bush Doctrine? Because if India follows the Bush Doctrine, insane as it was, this is how the insanity would play out. If India, so here's these guys who committed these atrocities, apparently trained in Pakistan. Apparently they're Pakistanis. Apparently they're associated with a Pakistani group that is devoted to independence of Kashmir or Pakistan annexation of Kashmir or parts of Kashmir. If that's the case, then the exact same argument could be made that George W. Bush made when he went into Afghanistan. Now, the Afghan government at the time said, you know, hey, you know, if Osama bin Laden was responsible for knocking down those towers, we will arrest him and turn him over to a third country for a trial. We're not sure, George Bush, that you are the guy who will give him a fair trial, but we'll give him to a third country where he will get a fair trial. And if you want to go along with that, that'll be fine. And if Bush had done that, all this death and destruction could have been eliminated. Osama bin Laden would not be a hero for a large chunk of the world. Al-Qaeda never would have gotten the foothold it never would have gone beyond being the 20 or 30,000 basically, you know, wackos that it has. But George Bush played right into their hand, did exactly what they want. Is the government of India going to do what these terrorists want? The world is saying, please don't be as crazy as George Bush. Please don't be as sick and twisted as George W. Bush. Please don't go to war with Pakistan over this. Pakistan is a nuclear-armed nation. Again, the lead editorial in today's Financial Times. Aggrieved as it justifiably feels, the Indian government of Manmohan Singh should respond to the strong peace feelers put out by Asif Ali Zardari, Pakistan's president. Only statesmanship of a high order can prevent this tragedy from turning into a triumph for the religious right in both countries. The blunderbuss tactics of George W. Bush. This isn't me saying, this is the Financial Times, you know, one of the most conservative newspapers in the world, the Wall Street Journal of the world of the UK. The blunderbuss tactics of George W. Bush enabled opportunistic governments, not just Israel and China, but Russia and Chechnya and China in Xinjiang, to reclassify regional conflicts as part of the, quote, global war on terror, end quote. The advent of Barack Obama is a chance to change tack. It is time to try once again, like, you know, throughout the last couple hundred years of history, it is time to try once again to agree on a universal definition of terrorism at the United Nations level. Yeah, let's define terrorism. Let's get this thing under control. Let's get reasonable again. Let's set behind us the insanity of the last few years. I want to get into also what's going on with the dollar. There's some concern that the dollar may be heading for a big crash. That and your calls, 866-303-2270, your telephone number, right after the break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
With a mighty host, a living sing. Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
If you want to feel those good vibrations coming from the joy that love can bring, turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on.
Oh, yes, turn your radio
and
on.
And listen to the music.
Well, just a few of the broadly other things in the news today. Today, by the way, is the 20th anniversary of World's AIDS Day. On this day in 1955, Rosa Parks defied the law by refusing to give up her seat to a white man aboard a Montgomery, Alabama city bus. And let us remember that for a dozen years before that, Rosa Parks had been a regular and, if not weekly, if not daily, at least weekly participant in an activist and resistance training group. She was part of a much larger civil rights movement. Again, you know, sometimes you have this moment in history when the right person just happens to be there. But far more often, it's that people are doing the hard work over the long haul, and then all of a sudden they get noticed, and everybody says, "Oh, look at suddenly that person is famous." You know, and it's not suddenly that person is famous. It's they paid their dues. They did their hard work. They did it for a long time. And, of course, today, a major anniversary, the 75th anniversary of the Bloody Mary cocktail, invented in Manhattan by French bartender Ferdinand Petiot in 1933. Bush, by the way, in an interview that will air on ABC News tonight, admits that he was unprepared to become commander-in-chief when he was elected. He says, I think I was unprepared for war. In other words, I didn't campaign and say, please vote for me, I'll be able to handle an attack. In other words, I didn't anticipate a war. Yeah. Please tell me anything that this man has ever done successfully in his life. Anything that George W. Bush has ever done successfully in his life. I can think of nothing. I can think of nothing. In the second hour of our program, we're going to be talking about fueling anti-union fires, the lies that are being put out about the unions right now, and the true nature of our economies. In our third hour, Jonathan Alter is going to drop by, Jonathan Tessini, and Governor Don Siegelman is going to drop in and say hi. And the Al Franken recount is continuing. The drama is continuing. We're going to see where that's going to go. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Greg in Los Angeles. Hey, Greg, welcome to the show. What's up?
George Bush is a success for those who wished him to make a mess.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, in the David Stockman sense, in the Grover Norquist sense, in the Ronald Reagan sense, that he has demonstrated that it is possible for an American government to be totally incompetent. I guess he's a success in that regard.
Tragic. Well, yeah, what you call incompetence is depends upon what their intentions were, and that you can't prove.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the ultimate. That's worse than any conspiracy theory, because as we know, that people have conspired many times, and luckily somebody made up theories to find them out, so that they could be discovered. But this Mumbai and this 9-1-1 and this war on terror is just further messes. And
if India were to follow the Bush doctrine, they would be attacking Pakistan right now, and we would have a nuclear war on the Indian subcontinent, and it could very easily become the beginning of World War III.
Well, that nuclear thing is one thing, but it would be no better than us going into Afghanistan just for one man, just like we went to Iraq just for supposedly for one man.
Yep, my point.
And the ridiculousness of war in general now is coming. The world is getting small enough so that everybody can see how it just continues a cycle of violence and continues the vengeance that will continue future wars.
Yeah,
if it's responded to the way that they are violent, if we respond in like kind, it will continue the cycle, and it's a vicious circle, and it's a mess that is created.
It's
in
absolutely
Israel.
Right. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth leads to a bunch of blind and toothless people. It's really that simple. Dag Hammarskjöld, 1952, as I recall, when he became head Secretary General of the United Nations, his autobiography, Markings, is a must read for everybody. Although it's a little esoteric, it's a brilliant book. We really must, Woodrow Wilson's vision of the League of Nations, we really must have international institutions that deal with peace, as the United Nations Charter explicitly says the United Nations was meant to do. Steve in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I guess it's on a religious issue, but I thought you had a pretty sophisticated analysis of the Roman Catholic Church, although having been Irish American and 14 years of Catholic education, I think I disagree a tiny bit in terms of, I think it comes from the top down, both legally and
I'm not sure what you're talking about, Steve.
Roman Catholic Church in terms of being involved in like the gay issue in California in terms of...
Actually, it was the Mormons who were the major funders. In fact, there's a huge investigation now into what was going on with the Mormons. because they were busing people in, flying people in, encouraging people to do their tithing by going to California. They were running huge phone banks. None of this was reported as campaign contributions. A lot of this is going to blow back on the Mormons, in my humble opinion, although I think that they think that this is setting up Mitt Romney's run for the presidency. You know, the Catholic Church has always been anti-gay. They believe it's part of their teachings, but so are many, probably most of the Protestant sects. There was a brilliant op-ed in, I think it was the New York Times over the weekend, by an African-American man, and he suggested that while the black vote didn't push Prop 8 over the top, it certainly didn't hurt. And he said it really was black women voting. And he said, don't try to convince them that this is a civil rights issue, because, you know, they've been through the civil rights stuff and they're not all that ready to see gays as an oppressed minority. They're still view themselves as an oppressed minority themselves. Don't try to, and along those same lines, don't try to characterize it as, you know, well, you know, back 10 years ago in most states, or 15 years, 20 years ago, it was illegal for blacks and whites to marry, because in many African-American women, they marry people of the opposite race about one-third as often as African-American men do. He said, just don't go there. He said the place to go is that gay African-American men hide their gayness, because it's an intolerant subculture, an intolerant culture. They hide their gayness, excuse me, by being bisexual, by having occasional sexual activity with women, so that they can brag about it and it's well known and so nobody thinks that they're gay. But then on the side, most of their activity is gay. And they are one of the primary vectors of HIV in the African-American community, which is hitting African-American women like crazy. And if gay men, gay black men, could come out and could marry and could be monogamous and thus not be vectors of disease and certainly not be infecting African-American women, then you've got a winning argument for the African-American community, particularly the women in the African-American community. He said, don't even try the church-going thing. He said, most of them are church-going. Don't say it shouldn't be a religious issue. They're going to say it is, all those other things. I thought that was... That frankly was brilliant. It was just an absolutely brilliant way to do it. Let's see, Stuart in Seattle. Hey, Stuart, what's on your mind?
Yeah, back to the Mumbai attacks. I hope you're not one of these crazy conspiracy theorists who think that a bunch of people got together and orchestrated and planned this thing in advance. Because if you are, you'll have to ask, what did they want the result to be? We first heard after these attacks started that a group calling itself the Deccan Mujahideen, which nobody had heard of before, claimed responsibility. So whoever orchestrated this attack wants us to blame a bunch of unknown Muslims, but there's no group to verify that we can say, oh, did you do this? No, we didn't claim responsibility, because there's no group. Then we have to ask, who do they want to attack Muslims? Well, we first heard that they were going after Americans and British, so let's get the Americans and British to attack some unknown Muslims. And then we have to ask, okay, this was done in India. Who are the Muslim enemies of India? Pakistan. Oh, how convenient. We've been starting attacks in Pakistan already. The United States has been working to extend the war, the so-called war on terrorism, into Pakistan. This is great. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I'm not disagreeing with anything you said, but you overlook this festering wound. I'm telling you, the last time I was in India, I was up in Dharamsala, just a couple hundred miles from Kashmir, and there were warnings about traveling those roads because of Kashmiri separatists. This is an area that for 40, 50, 60 years, people have been fighting over, and by fighting, I mean shooting and killing each other over, and it is largely religious. It is largely Hindu versus Muslim.
There's no doubt there was a festering wound, but that's exactly when it works so well. When somebody, tries to set up a fight between two people, they start with people that were already fighting, and then you bomb a Muslim mosque of one.
So are you suggesting that this was Dick Cheney's evil hand?
I think it could easily have been. You don't think it's past him, do you?
You know, I think he'd be a little more sophisticated. No, I don't think it's past him. You know, I'll go along with you on that. But you know, I think if Dick Cheney wanted to do it, frankly, Iran would be the boogeyman, not Kashmir. I suspect that this actually has to do with this long-standing debate, a disputed region of Kashmir and Jammu. But time will tell. 45 minutes past the hour.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Be a fine thing, wouldn't it? 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG. Hey, Julian, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. You know, the call you just had, who thought maybe there's some kind of strange plot that Cheney is pulling. It was kind of coincidental that the day before everything broke loose in Mumbai, we had the FBI warning that there might be an Al-Qaeda attack in Long Island, New York, you know, with planting bombs on the train, and suddenly that whole story just disappeared.
Well, apparently India was warned of this, and, you know, we might have gotten wind of that, and almost certainly did. You know, if you want something that Dick Cheney was involved in, look at Georgia. I mean, here was Randy Shuneman, you know, Karl Rove. They're both meeting with Saakashvili, the president of Georgia, just 3 weeks before he starts dropping bombs on civilians in Svengali. And, you know, while Bush is sitting with Putin at the Olympics. And then, you know, when it starts going south really fast, because Putin, you know, is a black belt who can kill a person with one hand and proud of it. When it starts going south really fast, Saakashvili, the so-called small D democratic president of the country, the guy who throws his political enemies in jail and shuts down TV stations during elections, some Democrat, right? He goes on TV and you would think he would say, world, please help. UN, please help. President Bush, please help. No, he says, John McCain, please help me. This was, in my opinion, organized by Karl Rove to help the John McCain campaign. And of course, within 24 hours, John McCain's out on the stump saying, let's not talk about Iraq anymore. Let's talk about Russia. That big bear, they're coming to get us. I'm a cold warrior. I fought Russia all my life. I know how to do this. I was fighting Russia when they were in a proxy war in Vietnam, blah, 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 blah. I am real ready to go with you on a conspiracy theory. Here, you know, a little more of a problem. As I said, I've been to India a whole bunch of times. I continue to say, although it's a terribly, terribly, terribly imperfect metaphor or analogy, that the Israeli-Palestinian situation and the Kashmiri situation is not totally analogous, but you know, it's better than any other metaphor I can come up with. You know, maybe North and South Ireland 30 years ago kind of thing. But it's just, you know, one of these long-standing, festering border. Not just border, territorial disputes that are grounded in religion and are grounded in colonialism, in British colonialism, and, you know, redrawing lines and things at the whim of the Brits.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I'm just wondering, has there been anything more in the news about the supposed Al-Qaeda attacks in Long Island?
No, I've not seen anything, and I've been looking. So, to the best of my knowledge, no. Julian, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Jack in Miami. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I was listening to you. I heard you say about the comment that Bush made that he wasn't prepared for the war.
Yeah.
And, you know,
you'll get to see it on TV tonight.
What's that?
You get to see it on TV tonight.
Okay, great. I'll look forward to that one. Hey, but the point is, as I think your reaction is, you know, George Bush couldn't do anything with you, and you would approve of it. Yeah, I think back of during the campaign, If anything, I would take that as a self-deprecating comment. I think back during the campaign when Clinton, somebody asked him if Obama was ready to be president. He said, well, he didn't think anybody would be is ready to be president. So he goes above and beyond the scope of Bush's answer, and he used it as a way to blast Obama. But, you know, I think this is a bigger symptom of where you are. You know, at some point, Tom, you're not going to be able to say it's Bush's fault. And, you know, I just kind of flip around the dial.
I'm telling you, I have never been saying it was Bush's fault, frankly. I've pointed out, Jack, over and over again that Bush is incompetent, but really the problem goes back to 1981. This problem goes back to the belief that government is the problem and not a potential solution. It goes back to people who hate the idea of small-d democracy, who don't believe that the American people are smart or competent enough to govern themselves through their elected representatives.
Well, let me ask you this, Tom. Was Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, was that a problem, or was that a big whoop-de-doo success?
Jack, I get it. You're going to try and let's see how many talking points and gotchas we can play. Do you want to have a serious conversation, Jack? I mean, what's the deal here?
Well, how do you feel about that? Should we go back and implement those old policies of loaning money to people who can't pay mortgages?
The 3/5 of the people, Jack, who got subprime mortgages, first of all, no, we shouldn't have been doing subprime mortgages. 3/5, and you can thank Phil Graham for that going back to 1999. Secondly, 3/5 of the people who got subprime mortgages qualified for prime mortgages and were never told because the subprime mortgages were more profitable. What you're seeing, Jack, is the failure of the so-called free market. You're seeing the failure of the Republican, the conservative philosophy that corporations can always do it better, and the less regulation there is, the better things will be. I'm telling you, capitalism is a fine system as long as it's regulated. If it's not, it's just like football's a great game as long as you have referees and goalposts. But when you do away with the referees and the goalposts, it's not football anymore. And it just, it's so pathetic to hear conservatives call up and go, look at this, we got rid of the goalposts and it fell apart and I guess you shouldn't have had a game, huh? No, come on. We can do better than that. We really can. As Americans, we can do better than that. Janice in Long Beach, we got just a few seconds here before the top of the hour. Janice, what's up?
Hi, Tom. As usual, you are right about this long festering wound that is Kashmir. But pardon my cynicism, but as you know, a military industrial complex that is running the country for the last.
Let's just start calling it the war industry because that's what it is.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know that you said that the previous caller said that he wouldn't put it past them being a conspiracy. I totally agree. They probably would have preferred Iran, but I think they'll take it wherever they can get it.
Yeah. Yeah, you may well be right. And all the more the tragic it is. All the more tragic it is. Coming up next, let's talk about this whole situation with the unions. $70? No, they're really not. In fact, the new union hires are making $14 and $15 an hour. But nonetheless, the vilification of the unions, the destruction of the unions, the destruction of the American middle class. Walter Brash will be with us. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So is the middle class really in decline? Ask the middle class. I think they say yes! Help! Life vest, please! Dr. Walter Brash knows quite a bit about these things. A media analyst and critic in pop culture, civil liberties, all sorts of things. His books include Sinking the Ship of State, The Presidency of George W. Bush, Unacceptable, The Federal Government's Response to Hurricane Katrina, and America's Unpatriotic Acts. His website, Walter Brash, BRASCH.com. And Walter Brash, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey, thank you very much.
You wrote an absolutely brilliant piece recently. It was titled The Media Ought To, pun there, A-U-T-O, Know Better, Fueling Anti-Union Fires. And I wanted to get you on and talk about this. First of all, I'm not sure exactly where it first appeared. You want to plug that, or is it at your website?
Well, yeah. excuse me. Basically, the column goes out to a bunch of websites, Op-Ed News and Counterpunch and Daily Cost and a few others, as well as a few newspapers in Pennsylvania that take it. And then I have my own mailing list, and they get it a little bit after the media gets it.
Great. So on your favorite progressive website, you can probably track this down. Certainly, you can Google it, or you can just go to walterbrash.com. Assuming I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
You certainly are.
You, in your article, point out that there is a lot of what the media might politely call disinformation flying around, what I will call anti-union lies, and they are being repeated by the corporate media, by the CNNs, ABC, NBC, CBSs of the world, MSNBCs, whatnot. And that many of them seem to originate with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, for example. The chamber saying that wages adjusted for inflation for workers rose 30% from 1967 to 2007. Wow, wages went up 30% over, what would that be, 40 years if I'm doing my math right?
Yeah.
Isn't that a little less than 1% a year?
Yeah, it's about 0.75%. What's amazing is that the news media looks at 30% and they say, wow, look at the workers' wages going up that high adjusted for inflation. And then they start to think, well actually they're not thinking that's part of the problem.
Right.
Is that 0.75% a year, and even my savings account, which is very paltry, gets better than that.
Right. After inflation. Now, any sense of how productivity has gone up during that same period of time since those two historically attract each other?
Oh, yeah, it's gone up significantly. Part of the reason is because when a company downsizes, it suddenly gives everybody else more work at the same wages, basically. So what happens is the individual workload is actually going up, whereas productivity is going up because of the workers. Profits have gone up until like a couple of years ago. And everybody is saying, gee, isn't it wonderful? We're getting by on, instead of 100 workers, we now can do the same job with 60 workers.
Right. And I understand. One of those great articles that you find and then you lose, it's somewhere in my many piles back at the office in Portland, hopefully. An article maybe 2-3 years ago that somebody actually dug into the numbers of productivity, the way the government calculates productivity. And found that if you had a company, say you and I ran a computer making company, you know, just a small one, and we had 100 employees, and we were making computers here in the United States, and we decided to lay off 70 of our factory guys and move that production to China and simply buy the computers from China for the cost of maybe 20 of the employees' wages and bring those computers in, our productivity, in other words, the net output, the number of computers we're producing, would remain the same. Our labor force would have been cut down to 20 or 30 people from 100, and so the government would say that we just tripled our productivity.
Exactly. And the thing about numbers and statistics is anybody could take those same numbers and play with them and come up with different answers.
Right.
And certainly that's what the chamber and a whole lot of our local newspaper, not local, but national newspapers and TV shows did with the nonsense about workers at the UAW making $70 an hour.
Yeah, $146,000 a year, Ford, Chrysler, and GM. My dad worked in that industry his whole entire life. He worked in a tool and die shop just a quarter mile from the Oldsmobile factory in Lansing, Michigan. They supplied a lot of stuff to Oldsmobile. And and two of my brothers worked in that field. I just don't see it happening. maybe in a weird, you know, every now and then there's one of these weird months, you know, where everybody has to work a crazy amount of overtime and works out pretty well as a consequence of it. But nothing like this. This is a nonsense number. How is it that a BS number like $70 an hour could get out into the corporate media like this?
What happens is that the automakers themselves always have really, really good PR people, and they know how to spin.
You're talking about the car companies, not the car workers.
No, not the car workers, and they put out the numbers, and of course some of our national columnists and TV people, they see, wow, this is terrible, $70 an hour. So instead of actually going in and demanding all the data and analyzing it, they just take what they've been told, and they say it's $70. Now, what that $70 is, I mean, technically, if you spend it right, it is $70 an hour, but that includes every cost associated with labor. It includes every retired person, which basically is not a worker, so they do all sorts of modern math, apparently, that I didn't even learn in school, and they come up with this $70 an hour.
Well, and these, a lot of these dollars that are supposedly being paid by the auto workers, particularly retirement dollars, people who are living off their pensions or people who are getting health care, those were dollars that were paid in by the workers back in the day. In fact, there was a fascinating article on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Now, this was 3-4 years ago, but and things may have changed since the stock market has fallen so much and most pension funds were invested in the stock market. But General Motors was actually making a profit on its pension fund.
Exactly.
Its workers paid into its pension fund. Its pension fund was producing, was invested in the market. It was producing more money than they anticipated they would have to pay to their workers. And there was a movement within GM to start skimming some of that profit off the pension fund. And now they're claiming that this is an expense.
Yes, exactly. And you know, the thing is that you point out exactly accurate is that the workers, you know, put in money to their retirement. And certainly, when the large manufacturers or any business figures out income, they always manage to figure out all those extra benefits, and they put in, you know, like the benefits they have to pay towards Social Security that the company does, or unemployment, or Medicare. All of this is federally mandated, but they say, well, that's also worker expense. What they don't say is we also get to deduct that from our income taxes.
Right.
And so what happens is it's a very distorted type of thing. But even if you distort everything and say every possible benefit and the worker base salary, which is about $28 according to the Council for Automotive Research.
$28 an hour?
About $28 an hour. And
which
that's
is 58,000 a year, which is just a little above the national median, which I think is around 50,000, isn't it?
Exactly.
49 and change.
You figure living in Detroit is a lot more expensive than living in the middle of Nebraska, maybe.
Yeah.
So when you compare it to the rest of the country, Detroit living expenses are more. Plus, these are, a lot of these people are very skilled laborers, and they have a job, they have a responsibility. And they're very good at what they do. And we're denying them $58,000 when CEOs are making eight-figure incomes.
Yeah. Now, why is it, why do you think, we're talking with Walter Brash, his brilliant article, The Media Auto, AUTO, Know Better, Fueling Anti-Union Fires, at walterbrash.com. And we have just a minute left here, Walter. Why do you think it is that CNN never reports on how much the white-collar workers are making in these auto manufacturers?
There's a whole lot of white-collar workers working in the media. That's part of our problem, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's
also this is really a very subtle form of classism. It's a class war.
Yes, it is. Exactly.
It's not even subtle, frankly.
All of us journalists, you know, we got college degrees. You know, we're important. We make money. And part of the problem, too, is that they don't get in and talk with the workers. I mean, we've got a company in my hometown that is back to one-day-a-week production. It has about 150 employees. They're doing one day a week because of reduced orders. I don't see any news like that because the news media, the journalists, are not out there talking to the workers.
Yeah.
They're waiting for press releases. They're waiting for police reports. They wait for a car crash, and they run out and take a picture. So we're not getting that. We've got business sections in our newspapers. We don't have a labor section.
Right, and we haven't for 30 years, you know, basically
exactly.
Since Reagan. I mean, you know, the consolidation and the Reaganization of America, and all the more the tragedy. 16 minutes past the hour. Walter Brash, the media ought to know better. Fueling Anti-Union Fires, a brilliant article. WalterBrash.com, the website. Walter, thanks for dropping by today.
Hey, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Good talking with you. 866-303-2270 is our telephone number. TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. And AirAmerica.com for our video stream. Tom Hartman here live from New York.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Nobody knows where the rivers flow, and I call it home, and there's no more lies in the darkness of life.
Well, and it goes beyond just workers' salaries and the lies that are being told about them. I'm telling you, there is a, as Warren Buffett famously said, yes, there is class warfare in the United States, and my class is winning. Warren Buffett, the second richest man in the United States. It goes beyond that. And, you know, I got an email a little bit ago from somebody who said, you know, this is the coup d'etat that was attempted against Roosevelt, the General Smedley Butler outed, you know, the let's bring down the government, this whole economic disaster, this Henry Paulson, let's spend $1 trillion. Now it's up to 3.5, 4, depending on how you calculate it, maybe as much as $7 trillion, which is half the GDP of the United States, excuse me, that is being given away to these bankers. Yeah, you know, $700 billion for bankers, white-collar guys, multimillionaires, no problem. Some money, you know, $25 billion for auto workers? Yeah, those guys, you know, they just graduated from high school. They wear blue shirts, you know, they're blue-collar workers. I don't know if we're, you know, and geez, they're making $28 an hour. So, and then you get Mika Brzezinski. Oh, they're making $73 an hour. Holy cow! Mika, who's probably making, you know, 30 times that, but believing the lies that are put out by the auto manufacturers who are trying to break their unions and who are trying to get you and me to pick up the costs, you know, for their retired workers, and so that they can pocket the money, because those retired workers actually paid that money in back in the day when they were working. But anyhow, there's a larger issue here. There's a much larger issue here. Let's step way, way back and look at this economy at, you know, from 10,000 feet. Let's step back and look at it from 20,000 feet. Here's the bottom line. When a country manufactures things, it makes wealth. The fastest way to make wealth, to create wealth, not money, not income, wealth. There's a difference. The fastest way to create wealth is manufacturing. You take $5 worth of iron ore and you turn it into $500 worth of car door. You take $5 worth of raw cotton and you turn it into a $5,000 Armani suit. Or $5 worth of wool, I guess it probably would be, whatever the case may be. Manufacturing has the greatest ratio of input to output in terms of converting something from low value to high value, and thus in the process creating wealth. You take a bunch of iron ore, and what you end up with is an instrument that is capable of great precision work. You know, a computer, a fancy computer. Oh, okay, look at all the things a computer does. It all started out as a bunch of minerals. A little bit of germanium, a little bit of silicon, a little bit of aluminum, a little bit of iron, a little bit of molybdenum, a little bit, you know, and just dirt, right? Your computer started out as dirt. And through manufacturing, it got turned into something that's worth thousands of dollars. Manufacturing is the way you produce wealth. Now, you can produce a little bit of wealth by selling things or by providing services. You could argue that a doctor produces wealth when he heals somebody. I would submit to you that the income that doctor earns isn't the production of wealth. The actual production of wealth is that the healthy person can now work a little longer and produce wealth by manufacturing. Are you with me on this? The way to make wealth is by making things. It's manufacturing. We don't manufacture in the United States anymore. Ronald Reagan and Arthur Laffer, I couldn't believe it. Arthur Laffer was on Bloomberg over the weekend a couple of times. And I thought, what are they doing with this grade A idiot, treating him as if he actually has something intelligent to say? This is the guy who for the last 30 years has destroyed the American economy, and they're still treating Arthur Laffer as if he has the IQ of somebody who graduated from elementary school. I was astounded. So the process of no longer manufacturing things means that since we're no longer on the gold standard, our dollar is backed by the full faith and confidence of the United States. In other words, our dollar represents the wealth of our country. And our wealth is what we make and what we have. And what we have is the minerals, you know, the gold and the trees and the iron ore and all that stuff. And like crazy, we're digging that stuff out of the ground and we're shipping it off to China and to India and to Europe. Countries all over the world. We're the largest exporter of raw materials now, third world country. So our indigenous wealth is vanishing, and our manufactured wealth is vanishing. Try and buy a toy that was made in the United States. Try and buy clothes that were made in the United States. Try and buy a computer that was made in the United States. Try and buy a TV that was made in the United States. 30 years ago, all those things were made here in the United States. We created wealth in this country. So the outcome of this, the product of this, is that the full faith and credit of the United States, in other words, the wealth of our country, is disintegrating. Now, there is a real predictable consequence to this loss of real wealth in the United States. And that consequence is that the value of the dollar could well crash. The Financial Times today has what I think, frankly, in the 6 years I've been doing this radio show, is the scariest article I've ever read in the Financial Times. I'll share it with you right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Just love the holiday season. Oh, welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the mothership, the headquarters of Air America in New York City. And 866-303-2270, your telephone number, if you want to drop into our live chat room. It's at tomhartman.com. Tom Vision, I think it's working. There's a button right at the top of tomhartman.com. Real easy to find. And a little harder to find over at airamerica.com, but it's there, and you can track it down, which is actually, you know, where it's hosted from, airamerica.com. So, anyhow, I promised you this article from the Financial Times. And, again, I want to just reset this. Wealth is created by making things. Adam Smith talked about this. I may be wrong on this, but I think it might have even been Aristotle who talked about a stick has no intrinsic value until you carve it, and then it becomes an axe handle, and suddenly it has value. Probably wasn't. It was probably some other economist. But in any case, that's one of the more famous examples. Adam Smith talked about, you know, spinning wool, taking sheep and turning them into sweaters, basically turning milk into cheese, turning grapes into wine, how manufacturing creates value. And because we don't manufacture anything in the United States, because for the last 30 years we have been exporting our jobs, and we've been doing so to the benefit of transnational corporations. Keep in mind, over 40% of all international trade that the United States is involved with, all trade in and out of the United States, is within single companies. In other words, 40% of all trade in the United States is Hewlett-Packard sets, which is an American company, sets up a factory which they own in China, where they hire Chinese people to make printers at 30 cents an hour, and then they ship those printers back to the United States free of tariffs. It's simply a scheme. It's a scam. It's a scheme to eliminate American labor costs and only have to pay Chinese labor costs. That's what we call free trade. And 40% of all that trade is just what I described. The remaining 60% of trade, more or less, is the classic kind of trade where you're buying things that just aren't made here. You know, in Thailand, they carve sandalwood. You know, we don't even grow sandalwood here. I mean, it's an extreme example, but, you know, for example. or making Saabs in Sweden, or making BMWs in Germany, that kind of thing. Just buying things that you just don't make here in this country. So anyhow, because we don't make things here in this country anymore, because we've become a so-called service economy. Remember that phrase from the Clinton administration? We're becoming a service economy. It's a new world. It'll be a fine thing, the service economy. There is no such thing. Service economy is an oxymoron. I'll wash your car. You may mow my lawn. It seems like something's going on. It seems like we're both working hard. It seems like we're trading something of value. But in fact, nothing of value is being produced. A service economy is not a real economy. A manufacturing economy is a real economy. So anyhow, here's the article. This is Harvey Morris at the United Nations writing in today's Financial Times, the headline, UN economists warn the dollar, that's our currency, is in for a hard landing next year. The current strength of the U.S. dollar is temporary. And the U.S. currency risks a hard landing in 2009, according to a team of UN economists who foresaw a year ago that a U.S. downturn would bring the global economy to a near standstill. In their annual report on the world economy published today, the economists say the dollar's sharp rebound this autumn has been mainly driven by a flight to the safety of the international reserve currency as the financial crisis spread beyond the U.S. The overall trend, however, remains a downward one, reflecting perceptions that the U.S. debt position is approaching unsustainable levels. Quoting the study, investors might renew their flight to safety, though this time away from dollar-denominated assets, thereby forcing the U.S. economy into a hard landing and pulling the global economy into a deeper recession. This is the annual survey of the United Nations, the UN's Department of Economic and Social Affairs. They note there has been a massive shift of global financial assets into U.S. Treasury bills, driving their yields almost to zero and pushing the dollar sharply higher. But at the same time, the U.S.'s external debt has risen to new heights that could provoke a dollar collapse. Now, a dollar collapse is one incredibly mind-bogglingly hell of a scary thing. I was in Argentina when the Argentina currency collapsed. People in normal middle-class suburban households, I was staying with a family down there, some people that I knew, and all down the street, you would see people with their televisions or their sofas in their front yards with price tags on them. They were selling things in order to be able to pay their mortgages. That's what happens when a currency collapses. A country gets real poor real fast. The report recommends reform of the international reserve system away from an almost exclusive reliance on the dollar and towards a globally backed multi-currency system. Why? Because 26 years of Reaganomics has destroyed the dollar. The only reason anybody takes dollars right now is because oil is denominated in dollars. And the oil-producing countries are rapidly moving away from that. Venezuela doesn't want to take dollars anymore. Iran doesn't want to take dollars anymore. Increasingly, countries are saying, nope, not going to take dollars. And so we may well see the prediction that people who put their money in other currencies, you know, buying Canadian loonies, buying Swiss francs, things like that, you know, just parking them in money markets and foreign currencies, or who buy commodities, who are buying oil stocks, gold stocks, things like that, or, you know, physical commodities. As the dollar collapses, we'll see the value of their investments hold. But otherwise, America is going to get real poor real fast, according to the United Nations. Why? Because we don't create wealth here anymore. And a lot of our natural resources have been stripped. There's not that much left. Reagan and Bush and Clinton and Bush and their buddies have raped this country. They have taken everything we've got. They have stripped our manufacturing. 40% of all international trade is simply a scheme to offshore labor. Millions, tens of millions of well-paying jobs, good-paying jobs have left this country. And you know, just like I say, you know, people say, well, you know, do you want the government telling you who your doctor should be? That's the wrong question. The question should be, do you want the government telling you who your doctor should be, or do you want a private corporation telling you who your doctor should be? Similarly, do you want the government defining your trade policy? Well, the actual question is, do you want the government defining your trade policy, or do you want Sony defining your trade policy, or Hewlett-Packard? Do you want it to be transnational corporations, as it is with the WTO, or do you want it to be sovereign states whose elected officials are answerable to we the people? It's just that simple. And if we don't return to a rational trade policy, we've got nothing left, and our dollar's going to collapse, and we're going to be so screwed. And the Republican, you know, Dick Cheney has already moved all of his money out of dollars. Little footnote in his financial disclosure statements before the last election, like 5-6 months ago, little footnote in Cheney's disclosure statements that he no longer has any of his hundreds of millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, close to $100 million, none of it is in dollars anymore. It's represented in European funds and in Saudi funds and in Halliburton stock, and Halliburton's no longer a U.S. company. Now, what does Dick Cheney know that you and I don't? Well, now you know. I'm telling you, this is a rolling disaster. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, and Carlos in Miami. Hey, Carlos, what's up?
Tom, thank you for taking my call. Very well said about the created wealth. My question is the following. Can agriculture products create wealth for a country?
Yeah, they're just, and you know, this kind of Adam Smith 101, and this was the big debate, frankly, between Jefferson and Hamilton back in the day. Jefferson said agriculture is a great way to produce wealth, and it is, actually. You know, you get one farmer with one tractor and 1,000 acres and a little bit of fuel and some seed and some fertilizer, and poof, he can produce thousands of dollars worth of food. It does produce wealth. It doesn't produce wealth as efficiently as manufacturing, though. I mean, it's probably, I don't know, somewhere between 10 to 1 and 1,000 to 1, depending on the kind of manufacturing. But it does produce wealth.
Okay. Reason why I ask you the question is because I've tried just about everything else in business here in America, and nothing has worked. I was a businessman for about 25 years, and as you know how the economy is, I have decided to move down to I'm European descendant, but was born and raised down in Colombia. I'm sorry, in Peru. And basically, I'm going to go back to farming. There's no other way that I think to protect and have enough something to feed my family.
Well, that's the original wealth. And if the goal of having wealth is to be able to have a roof over your house and have your family fed, you know, to satisfy the needs at the bottom of Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of human needs, his pyramid, then that's back to the basics. And Louise and I did that once. We bought a bunch of land in New Hampshire and thought, okay, this is it. We're going to go back to farming. And you know, people were creating communes all over this country in the 60s. They thought this was going to happen. Now it is going to happen. And I suspect we're going to see a trend like that again. We'll see. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Checkered past, what's all this interrogating, baby? Forget about that. You don't want to ask no questions you don't know the answer to. You might wish that I was lying once you heard the brutal truth. I can think a thousand things I'd rather do than you, and the time that it would take me to explain the way I am. Honey, I could be well on my way to being your new man. You could waste a day away digging up my buried bones. You could turn it up and shake it, shake it all night.
Take it back to mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here. Tom Hartman here with you. And, oh, man, strange stuff going on out there. Yep, in Asbury Park, New Jersey, the U.S. Marshals, they did this amnesty program. They said, hey, you know, if you're a criminal and you've got a warrant out against you and you want to turn yourself in, we'll cancel the warrant. No jail time. Yeah, you might have a small fine or something, but we'll just make sure you don't go to jail. A whole bunch of people, 2,245 of them, in fact, showed up, turned themselves in. 83 of them had no warrants. They confessed to crimes that the police didn't know about. Yes, very strange. Okay. U.S. economists warn that the dollar's in for a hard landing next year. That, now, combine that with another story out of the Financial Times today. Concerns grow about ability of states to raise debt, states being countries. Greece, Italy, the Netherlands, U.S., U.K., Germany, France, Ireland, Spain, Portugal, Belgium, and Finland. They're saying all of these countries are going to have trouble borrowing money this year. Fears are raising of the ability of governments to raise the vast amounts of debt they need to pay for economic stimulus packages and bank bailouts. See, this is the thing. If these people just got, if they just said, okay, you want to restore the economy? You know, China's growing at 10% a year. Why? Because they're manufacturing things. Wages in China are going up dramatically. Why? Because they're creating value. All you have to do is start producing value, which means manufacturing things, which means change these insane tariff laws back to the way they were from 1791 to 1982 when Ronald Reagan started tinkering with these things. And particularly the 1990s when Bill Clinton blew them up. And gee, we might have a country back. What a radical idea. What a strange notion. I get a country back? Amazing. Warren in Snoqualmie, Washington. Hey, Warren.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air. What's up?
Tom, my comment was that I believe that the value of money should be tied to the amount of energy that a human can create, sort of like a horsepower, but a human power, or a heurg, as I call it. Mm-hmm. And I think that were the value of our money tied to that, that it would be something that would be stable.
Jack Vance is an old friend and one of the very best science fiction writers of the 20th century. He's just a brilliant guy. Jack and Norma, wonderful people. And he wrote a whole series of novels starting back in the late 40s, early 50s. And
who was that?
Jack Vance, V-A-N-C-E. And
yeah, I'm a well-read science fiction reader, but I don't think I've read much by Jack Vance.
Well, then you're not well-read as a science fiction reader, I'll tell you. Jack Vance is absolutely brilliant. His Chai Planet of Adventure series is a great place to start, or the Demon Princes series. But in any case, he has created this, you know, the Gaian Reach, he's created this universe, all these worlds, and that have been largely consistent over the 40, 50, 60 years that he's been, he's still writing. And he's in his, I think, late 80s now. He's been blind for some time. Producing is brilliant. And he has a unit of currency that stands throughout the entire galaxy or throughout the universe and multiple galaxies. And it's called the SVU, the standard value unit. And it represents 1 hour of one person's labor anywhere it may be. And some people get more SVUs for their labor than others, but there's this baseline. And much like what you just suggested, he has based currency on the value of labor. And I think it's a great idea, Warren. I think it's a better idea than basing currency on the value of gold, frankly. By the way, there was an interesting analysis. I believe it was in the Financial Times. I read it over the weekend. Saturday. I was flying from Portland to New York, and it might have been the Financial Times, might have been one of the other newspapers I read, where somebody did an analysis of what it would take to go back on the gold standard. If we went back on the gold standard right now today, you take the U.S. gold reserves, you divide it by the size of our economy, and gold in a U.S. dollar would be around $7,000 an ounce. Gold in the euros would be around 6,400 euros an ounce. I thought that was fascinating. Very, very interesting. So lots going on here. Mike in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Oh, hello, Tom. Apropos something one of your previous callers was saying about how capitalism needs to be regulated, there's an aphorism I use often when I'm debating this with my conservative friends. I don't know if I'm the one who originated it or not, but it's capitalism requires regulation for the same reason that a knife has to have a handle. It's just a tool. You need a place to grab it so you don't get cut.
Yeah, don't you think a better one would be capitalism needs regulation the same way that a football game requires goalposts, line markings and referees?
That's a good one, too. But when I see people actually literally losing their livelihoods and committing suicide because they can't pay their mortgage, the danger to life and limb thing seems quite relevant to me.
Yeah, Yeah, that's an interesting one, Mike. Thank you very much. And the bottom line, what we're both saying, is that capitalism is simply an economic system, and it has to have rules. It has to have rules that it works with. And you get these crazy guys like Phil Graham who say do away with the rules, and they're arguing for national suicide. Leonard in Phoenix. Hey, Leonard.
Hi, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Tom. I got to meet you when you came down to Phoenix with Jeff Ferris. It was great. Hey, Tom, we're really concerned down here, and, you know, thanks to you, it's like getting an education on the radio, you know, basically for poor boys like me who, you know, had to go through find different ways to fund their way through school. And this whole thing about the dollar collapsing, you know, I was raised by parents in the Depression, and, you know, this brings this all back. And we're really worried down here in Arizona. Our pension fund, probably like many others across the country for the teachers, has lost billions of dollars or lost quite a bit of money. And now our governor is getting ready to leave us. And basically, quite frankly, we have such a virulent right-wing group of people down here running our government, we don't know what's going to happen to us. Yep. So, Tom, thank you very much, and keep up the good work. And I just hope to God that Barack Obama is our new FDR.
I agree. Well said, Leonard. Thank you. These guys have to get it, that manufacturing creates wealth, and we need to bring manufacturing home to the United States. Jonathan Alter, along those themes, from Newsweek magazine, with us up next. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So Franklin Delano Roosevelt, when he first came to power, basically set it up. He said, you know, if you're not going to give me the legislation I need, I'm going to take that power. FDR, in his acceptance speech, his inaugural speech on the 4th of March, 1933, here we are at a period that is very, very much like that. And he just laid it right out. Here is FDR. Here's about a minute and a half of FDR's acceptance, or his inauguration speech. Consider this.
Practices of the unscrupulous money changers stand indicted in the court of public opinion, rejected by the hearts and minds of men. Yes, the money changers have fled from their high seats in the temple of our civilization. We may now restore that temple to the ancient truth.
So he starts out identifying the bad guys, you know, and that, yeah, they've fled from the temples. The banks were closed, the traders, everything was all screwed up. But he's going to move forward, he says.
This nation is asking for action, and action now.
And it was. It was desperate.
There must be a strict supervision of all banking and credit and investment. There must be an end to speculation with other people's money.
Yeah, you know, FDR got it. He got what caused the problem. He said, we're going to solve this. We're going to regulate capitalism in the United States. We're going to solve this problem. He continues.
And there must be provision for an adequate but sound currency.
Yeah, always a good plan.
These, my friends, are the lines of attack I shall presently urge upon a new Congress in special session, detailed measures for their fulfillment, and I shall seek the immediate assistance of the 48 states. I am prepared under my constitutional duty.
Now, this is where it gets interesting. Roosevelt says, these are the things that need to be done. We need to do these things. I want the states to help me. I want Congress to help me. But if they're not, I'm going to do it myself.
To recommend the measures that a stricken nation in the midst of a stricken world may require. These measures, or such other measures, as the Congress may build out of its experience and wisdom, I shall seek within my constitutional authority to bring to speedy adoption. But...
And here it is. He says if Congress doesn't give him the power, he's going to take it.
In the event that the Congress shall fail to take one of these two courses, in the event that the national emergency is still critical, I shall not evade the clear course of duty that will then confront me. I shall ask the Congress for the one remaining instrument to meet the crisis. Broad executive power to wage a war against the emergency as great as the power that would be given to me if we were in fact invaded by a foreign foe.
There you go. Now keep in mind, this is the 4th of March, 1933. And FDR saying, I am declaring war on this depression, and if Congress isn't with me, I'm going to carry it forward in any case. That was FDR's inaugural address. Jonathan Alter is with us, the editor at Newsweek and columnist for Newsweek, senior editor at Newsweek magazine, newsweek.com, the website. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Tom.
You also are the author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope, just released in paperback and perfectly timed about FDR's first 100 days in office. John, FDR was, you know, no shrinking violet when it came to calling these guys out on who they were and what they were all about. I mean, he referred to them as the economic royalists. He vilified them. He talked about how the economic royal. In fact, here, let me just play one quick clip. This is about a 15-second clip of FDR talking about the economic royalists that I think you'll appreciate.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power. Our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
It requires the overthrow of this kind of power. That's the kind of language you find in the Declaration of Independence, John. Does Barack Obama have the iron in his spine that FDR had to call out the people who produced or created this problem and force the solutions down their throats even if they don't want it?
Well, first of all, we don't know yet because Barack Obama, like all presidents, are blind dates. And,
right.
You know, you really don't know until they get in there and have been there for a little while what they're going to be like. But one important point is that economic royalists clip is from 1936.
That's right.
Not 1933.
Yeah.
And at the beginning, there was a little bit of tongue lashing in that inaugural address in 1933. He talked about chasing the money changers from the temple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just played that part.
But,
actually,
you know.
Actually, he said they had fled the temple.
They had fled the temple, and that they had abdicated was his line at that time. At the time he was, you know, tongue-lashing the money changers, he was working with Herbert Hoover's Treasury Department on a quite conservative bank rescue plan that did not nationalize the banks, that did not go nearly as far as Hank Paulson has gone. And he was, you know, careful not to give the new dealers everything they wanted. He was pragmatic in a way that would seem familiar when you look at Obama. What happened later is interesting. And that is that the same people whose rear ends he had saved from destruction, because Roosevelt saved both capitalism and democracy in 1933, they were so ungrateful that it drove Roosevelt around the bend. Basically, he compared it to a lifeguard who saves a drowning man, and then the lifeguard comes back a few months later and says, "Where's my silk hat?"
Mm-hmm.
And Roosevelt was not amused. That the same people who he had saved the last of their fortunes for them by rescuing a system, then turned around and fought him every inch of the way.
So, well, and on top of that, if Smedley Butler is to be believed, they even tried to organize a coup against him.
Yes, and the a few of them did. I mean, the coup plotters. One of whom had a connection to the DuPont Corporation, approached a retired General Smedley Butler with a coup idea that went nowhere and was fairly quickly exposed. It was at a very early stage of planning, so we don't really know how many of those folks wanted him out. There's been a fair amount of nonsense written about the coup, but at a minimum, they detested Roosevelt. And in the famous New Yorker cartoon, it says, "Let's go down to the Lux," which was a theater, "and hiss Roosevelt." And that was their attitude. They felt he was a traitor to his class and the rest. And so Roosevelt, by 1936, was willing to, really take off the gloves. Although many of the people he was taking off the gloves against, he hired as dollar-a-year men to fight World War II. So he was very pragmatic in his use of people.
Yeah, and in 1937, he pulled back a little bit from the New Deal, which caused another drop in the economy.
Well, that's something that Paul Krugman and some others have been saying. That is a subject of considerable dispute. It's true that he started, mouthing platitudes about a balanced budget again for the first time in a few years. But there was not the great cut in government spending that you sometimes hear.
John, can you stick around for just a couple minutes?
Sure.
Take us to the bottom of the hour with us, because your book, The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope, is a brilliant and perfectly timed. And I would like to get into some of the parallels and some of the differences here, and you're really the guy to do it. Jonathan Alter, senior editor at Newsweek, newsweek.com. His book, The Defining Moment. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars. Jonathan Alter on the line with us, the senior editor at Newsweek and the author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope, now out in paperback, just re-released, about FDR's first 100 days in office. Jonathan, what are the lessons in your mind that in researching this book you found most important that FDR learned? I mean, he was in uncharted territory, whereas now perhaps we're not quite so uncharted. Although things, back then we were the world's largest manufacturer and the world's largest creditor, and now we're the world's largest importer of manufactured goods and the world's largest debtor. So things have changed somewhat.
Yeah.
But, so FDR had great, wealth and strength on which to build, and we have an enormous debt. Situation is somewhat different. But what are the things that you really learned from this that you think, if you could sit down with Barack Obama, you would tell him to do?
Well, what was more interesting to me than something that I could necessarily tell him is the lessons he's already learned from my book, as evidenced by the 60 Minutes.
He's reading your book.
Well, his office said after 60 Minutes that he was reading the book, and what was so interesting to me was that he had properly absorbed the key lesson, and he famous first
pragmatism.
Well, it's not just pragmatism, it's action. The famous first inaugural was famous because of the line, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself."
Right.
And in a lot of ways, that was a bit of inspired nonsense. It wasn't even paid much attention to. The clip that you quoted, that you aired, got a much, much bigger applause line than "The only thing we have to fear" line did. If you're worried about putting food on the table, that's something more than fear itself. So what Roosevelt understood was that we needed what he called action and action now. And he used that word action six times in that inaugural address. And Obama used it, I think, three times in the 60 Minutes interview. And he also talked about experimentation. And one of Roosevelt's great lines from the campaign, in a speech that was written by a reporter, actually, later of Newsweek. Nowadays, of course, you get fired if you wrote a speech for a politician, but things were different then. And Roosevelt said, "We need bold, persistent experimentation. Take a method and try it. If it fails, admit failure frankly." Now, as you know, Tom, that idea of admitting failure frankly is a complete novelty in the Bush era.
Yeah.
Right? Admit failure frankly and try another method, but above all, try something, unquote. So it's that spirit of experimentation, that idea of action, of working the problem, getting up every day and trying to dent the problem, even if you can't necessarily solve the problem immediately. And I do think that Obama has gotten that message from FDR, that the particulars of it, you know, whether you did this or that to hurt this or that interest group, whether you were hard or soft on Wall Street, you know, whether you took names, all of that was of less importance to Roosevelt than the idea of acting. And so that's towers above everything else in terms of its importance. And then the other thing that I think it's very important for Obama to absorb, and he's shown signs of absorbing it, is that this economy is about real people. So you have, you know, both Bush and Herbert Hoover were not interested in doing anything to help the people whose houses and farms had been foreclosed.
Right.
You know, and both Roosevelt and Obama are interested in helping those people. And so but one of the great bits of fortune for Obama is that this collapse came on Bush's watch, and that the Keynesian approach to it of pumping huge amounts of money into the economy was also done by Bush, because by shoveling all that money to Wall Street, which, by the way, in one form or another, and they did it stupidly at first, but in one form or another is necessary to unclog the arteries of commerce. But by doing that, they opened themselves up to an argument that you and I and every other progressive can make with the next year, which is, if it was good enough for greedy bankers, it's good enough for needy Americans. And it opens up, you know, that argument. And so Obama will have much more flexibility in making much needed investments that help real lives of real Americans.
You know, Jonathan, we're talking to Jonathan Alter, his book, The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope, at the top of the bestseller list now, Barack Obama reading it. You should, too. And, of course, Newsweek.com, he's the senior editor at Newsweek. Jonathan, to create wealth, a country has to manufacture things. And the United States was the leading manufacturer in the world in the 1930s, even during the Great Depression. We have now 40% of all international trade is within single companies. In other words, HP, for example, Hewlett-Packard, opens a factory in China. They manufacture in China, and then they sell to themselves in the United States and ship the product to the United States. It really has nothing to do with trade. It's a way of arbitraging labor. How can Obama, and we only have a half a minute left, how can Obama address this horrible problem?
Well, first of all, the economy in the United States was terrible in the 30s, you know, 25% unemployment. But I think that Obama can make a series of reinvestments in infrastructure, in green technology, in a new kind of auto industry. They can get us making things again. And also, don't run down services too much. You know,
yeah.
We have great brain power in this country. And
you're absolutely right.
Exploit it on behalf of the American people.
Very well said. Jonathan Alter, The Defining Moment. Thank you, John.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
How does it feel?
34 and a half minutes past the hour. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Jonathan Tessini is with us. Workinglife.org is website. Jonathan Tessini is the executive director of the Labor Research Association. That's workinglife.org, the website, and also just one of the more brilliant observers of the economic scene these days. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom. Sounds like you've been talking to my mother or something.
No, I've been reading your stuff. And to a certain extent, I'm part of the peanut gallery. I mean, you know, we're saying the same thing in a lot of our own writings about, you know, this Robert Rubin and about so-called free trade and all this kind of thing. Give us your overview, first of all, of the state of the American middle class since Ronald Reagan was elected president.
Well, it's been a disaster, and if you actually go back earlier than that, over the last 30 years, Americans have been working their butts off and haven't gotten the wages to reflect that. I mean, one of the statistics that always blows my mind is this, that if we got the wages that we deserved in terms of how hard we worked, the minimum wage today should be $19.12.
Wow. You mean if the minimum wage's increase was consistent with the increase in productivity?
Exactly.
$19 and how much?
$19.12. So 12 three
cents.
Times what is, that's the minimum wage, not
right.
The average wage.
Right. What would the average wage be?
The average wage, well, you actually, medium wage would probably be $20,000 more than what it is. It'd probably be around 60 grand or something like that. I mean, and not to mention pensions and health care. And so in some way, the crisis and the crime that we're seeing unfolding is not the one that we're looking at just in the last 3 years. As you often talk about in your program, it goes back a long time.
Yeah, yeah, it does. Even Jimmy Carter bought into some of this with his whole deregulation the last 3 years of his presidency. And although he continued to break up AT&T, even though he didn't initiate that process, but really it went on to steroids with Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush. And you've got this most recent piece that you wrote, Robert Rubin. Well, I'll let you characterize him in the piece.
Well, I was in my usual way. I was very subtle.
Yes.
I asked whether he was a coward or a liar. Right. I like to be a kind of, you know, calm about it. And I think the point is this. You know, one of the things that people like Robert Rubin and Alan Greenspan trade on is this sort of big idea that they know everything, that they can just walk in the halls of Congress and around the economy, and that they just have to open up their mouths and people, men and women, just weep at their brilliance.
It's kind of a distorted sense of royalty, excuse me.
Yes, exactly. And so they think that they know everything. And all of a sudden, you now see Robert Rubin claiming the Sergeant Schultz defense, which is, I knew nothing, I saw nothing, and I heard nothing about this entire collapse. And I should point out that he was not just Treasury Secretary. He gets a huge amount of money to help run Citigroup as one of the lead board of directors. So he now claims and is on this great public relations offensive in the last few days, that he knew nothing about the deep doo-doo that Citigroup was entering into, the result of which is now that we're on the hook for tens of billions of dollars, us meaning the taxpayers. He claimed he didn't know.
Right. Here's something that baffles me, Jonathan Tessini. How is it that these guys can say, this bank is too large to fail. If we let this bank fail, nothing will replace it, and there'll be a huge vacuum. And yet at the same time, they say, if we let GM fail, there will be thousands of entrepreneurs who will jump into the fray and start making cars day after tomorrow. Aren't there thousands of bankers who would jump into the fray?
Precisely. Well, you know, it's because it's their people. It's their coterie. It's the world that they walk in. They don't care about the auto worker. They don't care about the average stiff that went to a plant every day and worked. And they would never themselves think about working under the conditions that auto workers work under, because they're pretty terrible and people get decently compensated for that. But they just don't live in that world. And it is two different worlds. And I think that is two different worldviews and two different worlds in which they live in.
And tragically, the TV stars, and let's just call this what it is, in Walter Cronkite's day, they were actually journalists, and Walter Cronkite didn't make that much more than his producer, or frankly, that much more than his cameraman. And today, they're movie stars, they're TV stars. The TV stars who pretend to be news reporters and who read the news, These people also would never consider working under the conditions that, frankly, Walter Cronkite worked under that weren't all that different from an auto worker. That is to say, you know, working in an open cubicle with a whole bunch of people banging away on a real typewriter and having to do real work.
I think that's a brilliant point. Look, they don't live the life of regular people these days. And so they buy then into this whole notion of the so-called free market and so-called free trade. They may have taken the same economics 101 courses in college where all this nonsense is taught. They listen to the same people at the same cocktail parties that we never go to and that average auto workers don't go to. And so it feeds on itself. And to come back to Robert Rubin, he is the high priest of this kind of movement of the so-called free market and so-called free trade. And for him now to say, I didn't know, and this is why I said he's either lying, and the reason I said he could be a coward, because at least in this one article where he's defending himself, he blames a consultant that came before the board of Citigroup and told him this. And poor Robert Rubin, the guy who was Treasury Secretary, who likes to present himself as a master of the universe and running the world, he didn't know.
Now, the third option, Jonathan Tessini, that you don't mention is that he's just incredibly stupid.
Yes, but okay, yes, you could take that argument, but I think that would quite offend him, and certainly you can't. It's fascinating that a lot of people in power, once they are caught with their hands in the cookie jar, they can't quite say, well, I was stupid and wrong. And the irony of this is that Robert Rubin could really be a hero in one sense. He could say, you know what, I was wrong. And I made a huge mistake, and this whole nonsense about the free market has hurt a lot of people, and this is the entirely new direction we could go. Right. It's the same argument that we've had about other leaders like Hillary Clinton, who never told the truth about the Iraq War. And you just go down the list, these leading figures who could actually turn the country around and lead kind of to a new policy are too afraid to say, I goofed. So instead they have to lie.
Well, you know, Greenspan kind of came out and said, I goofed, although he didn't suggest any alternative, but he wasn't really in a position to. But so what? Here we have a series of myths. We have this myth that you can create wealth by having a service economy. You know, would you like fries with that? Somehow that's going to create wealth. Let me change the oil in your car. I mean, you know, manufacturing creates wealth, but you know, service. We have this myth that while 40% of all of the trade that the United States engages in is within company, it's intra-company, it's Hewlett-Packard opening a factory in China and manufacturing there and then selling to themselves in the United States just so that they don't have to employ U.S. people at a higher price. This myth of free trade. We've got this series of myths that since Reagan we have bought into. I mean, this has just been this tragic buying into, right up to the level of people like Robert Rubin and people like Bill Clinton who seem to believe this stuff. How do we deconstruct these things, lacking somebody who is going to be as plain-spoken and, frankly, as antagonistically spoken as Franklin Roosevelt was, at least by 1936, when he started calling out the economic royalists and calling them traitors?
So let me make a few points on all those good points. Number one, you know, the service economy is not necessarily a bad thing. And if you go back in the 1920s, 1930s, industrial jobs were terrible jobs. What made those jobs different was unions. So if you actually could unionize Walmart, those jobs would not necessarily be bad jobs.
No, but I'm putting this in the context of Adam Smith, you know, his concept that you know, a piece of wood has very little intrinsic value. You carve it into an axe handle and now it's utilitarian. It has greater value. That is manufacturing. That manufacturing, with manufacturing, you can take, you know, $100, or you can take $5 with an iron ore and you can turn it into a $5,000 car door. You can take $5 with a wool and you can turn it into a $1,000 Armani suit. You can't do that with the service industry. You can only slightly increase the value of things with service.
Okay, so I agree with your basic point. All I think that we need to look at is that jobs can be made good jobs if they're unionized. And that's what I think about when I think about workers
okay.
and having a decent economy.
Right.
But I think going back to the larger point is, I think we need to have an honest discussion with our country. And I think you do, you know, part of that, the way that happens is through your program and trying to get leaders to let go of this notion that there is this so-called free market and free trade and stop believing in this religion. It really is about the rules. And if we start talking about what are the rules that are going to govern the economy, how are we going to trade with other countries? how are you going to distribute wealth in this society? Are we just going to have it for the rich, or should we have real taxes the way we used to have it?
Right.
You know, that those are part of the dues that we pay for society. So it's a long, long process. I don't want to underestimate this. It's not going to happen overnight. I do think that one of the things we have to do is when people like Robert Rubin don't tell the truth, I think we have to hold their feet to the fire. And even, you know, I look at myself and I think you, well, I won't speak for you, but other people look at themselves. We have to be the loyal opposition out
there. You betcha. Our work began on November 5th. It didn't end.
Pardon me?
Our work began on November 5th. It didn't end on the day after Election Day.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, little things like we have to raise the question, why is there no labor secretary who is considered to be the same value of treasury secretary?
Yeah. So, yeah, your suggestion of John Edwards or somebody like that I thought was brilliant. Jonathan Tessini, just some absolutely great work that you're doing, and there it goes. Workinglife.org, the website, the executive director of the Labor Research Association. Thanks, Jonathan.
Pleasure.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Be singing this song,
it's right at the
but I have to tell you that something is wrong. We're not represented in D.C. no more. When they lie to your face just to profit from war, our leaders have failed us. The time is at hand to think for ourselves, every woman and man. The truth is that we have the voice and the power to pull them all down from their ivory tower. So stand and let your voice be heard. Stand and let your voice be heard. Stand up, speak out, this is still our country. So stand and let your voice ring.
Okay, and today's Financial Times. I keep coming back. Lots of great stuff in the Financial Times today. An article about how Andre Shepard, a U.S. Army specialist, went AWOL in Germany. And he's trying to get in Germany. He's asking for asylum. And the reason why his prospects are good, according to his lawyers, is legally his prospects are looking very good. The German Federal Administrative Court ruled in 2005 that the Iraq war violated international law and labeled the invasion an act of aggression. So this guy not only might get asylum, but this could be a lever that could be used in the German courts to prosecute some of the war criminals like Karl Rove. But I'm telling you, if you want a more direct path to nailing Karl Rove's friendly little butt to the wall, get Don Siegelman's case out in front of a court. Get Don Siegelman's case out in front of the world. Get Don Siegelman, he's coming up December 9th, do everything you can to help this guy out in this case out, because this is the thing that could make Watergate look like child's play. I just went to his website, Don Siegelman, SIEGELMAN.org. Remember I before E, except after C? DonSiegelman.org, and contributed $50 to it, which this is not the first time I've done that. And I encourage you to do the same. Governor Don Siegelman on the line with us. Governor, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Appreciate your support, and thank you for helping me fight for my freedom and fight for the truth. You know, if this administration, the new administration, the President Barack Obama administration, lets this slide, you know, these folks are going to come back with a vengeance. They have embedded themselves in U.S. attorneys' offices and within the Department of Justice and, you know, I'm sure all over the State Department and everywhere else. We have got to weed out these rogue clones and get them out before they come back and haunt us again.
Oh, they're not just haunt us again. I mean, they're going to try and sabotage everything the Obama administration does, and you know, it's just It's the 24/7, 365 day a year campaign, only in this case it's going to be a campaign of, frankly, political sabotage from the inside out. And I think that your case is the pivotal case. I really do. And I think that people, every single person listening to me right now needs to go to donsiegelman.com or donsiegelman.org, I before E, Siegelman, and toss some money your way to help with the legal defense fund. Cause I know this is, you're not a rich guy and this is breaking the bank. And in addition to that, call your member of Congress and say, investigate the Don Siegelman case.
Well, we have an opportunity, and it is not about me. It is about finding out and holding responsible those people who took over our Department of Justice and used it as a political weapon to win elections. And we already know from documentary evidence and from sworn testimony that Karl Rove was involved. We have had the House Judiciary Committee issue a subpoena for Karl Rove to show up and testify about his involvement in not only the my prosecution, but the firing of the U.S. attorneys. And, of course, he at first said that he would show up, then said he wouldn't show up. He would only testify if nobody was there to take down what he had to say, and he wasn't going to be under oath. And finally, just didn't show up at all. Now Congress is going to have to come back and sort of redo that because they did not vote to hold him in contempt before they adjourned. So we've got, when Congress comes back, the House Judiciary Committee needs to be pressed, as does the Senate Judiciary, to hold Karl Rove in contempt and bring him before the Judiciary Committees. And if he doesn't want to testify, he can take the Fifth or just not say anything. But he will, we've got to follow through with this and find out the truth.
Yeah, there needs to be an investigation. And you know, we should add, you were the governor of your state. You were prosecuted on what now turns out, and probably the appeal will demonstrate, was, you know, totally phony and fallacious charge. Nobody else had ever been prosecuted for this in the history. You know, in fact, if what you did is actually a crime, every politician in Washington, D.C. should be in jail, number one. And number two, you were prosecuted by the wife of the campaign manager of your political opponent, who was the business partner of, guess who, Karl Rove. I mean, this is, I tell this story to people and they look at me like, you know, come on, you're one of those tinfoil hat guys. I'm like, no, this is true.
They think you're making it up. No, but it sounds like a John Grisham story. Really, it really happens to be factual. And, it gets worse from there, but, we've got, the jurors talking to each other during the course of the trial and plotting and emailing and trying to get a conviction. They've got one juror doing flips in the jury room, showing off her gymnastic talents as she is passing messages to the prosecution, trying to get a date with the FBI agent who's sitting next to the prosecution while the trial is going on.
Yeah, it would make a great sitcom. I'll tell you. DonSiegelman.org for all the information. Don, D-O-N, Siegelman, S-I-E-G-E-L-M-A-N.org. Don, thanks. Governor, thank you so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Encourage your listeners to write or call Congress.
Thank That's you. Right. Write or call Congress now. CallCongress.org, by the way, has all the toll-free numbers. Tomorrow we'll be broadcasting from Liz Claiborne headquarters. It's Time to Talk Day on domestic violence, and Christian Weller, the Center for American Progress on the Middle Class, our feature this week. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.